And we got an Eastwood. Hello, sir.
Hello. Go ahead. Make my news.
All right. Let's see if I can get this clip to work here.
Hey, Vinny, this is Bill. How you doing?
Hi, Bill. I don't know who you are.
I don't know who you are, really. I'm kidding. I know exactly who you are. I thought you were like a 45-year-old man when I first heard your voice.
Really?
You got a great radio voice, man. You got pipes, as they say.
I got the pipes. Hey, I do have pipes.
In America, they always say, got great pipes on them, you know?
Yeah. Do they always say that, Bill?
In radio, he's got great pipes.
So in New Zealand, we usually use that to describe somebody who consumes vast quantities of marijuana.
Really?
You got great pipes, man. You got great pipes.
Hey, guys, take 48 seconds and watch this clip I just threw in, because today is episode 33 of Always Record.
Really?
Yeah.
You can't make this stuff up. I was just talking.
No, that's what we were just saying, how you can't make this stuff up. And it's like, actually, you can, but we aren't. Let's... so this is episode 33 of the old Batman TV show.
No shit.
Everyone got that?
Yeah, I don't need to keep watching it when it gets all weird, right?
Oh, I don't... Oh, is this... Did this get all weird?
No, they repeat it. It's all like, I founded Skull and Bones.
Oh.
Gets all...
Sorry, I just grabbed the first one I saw.
Right, but that's there.
Has anybody else noticed, if you're looking for the number 33, you see it literally everywhere? Like... I think last night my friend bought a new Spacey's machine. You know, you got all those old arcade games and stuff like that, and we're playing it. And we got kind of unlimited credits, so it's just however many times you press the button or whatever. So you just click it, and it just came up 33. And I don't know. I think it happened maybe 5 or 6 times yesterday alone that I saw the number 33. You know, like I had 33 Skype messages. 33 emails come in the day. You know, I don't know, 33 Facebook friends ads or something. I don't know. It just happens all the time. It's crazy. And you see it in the movies as well. Have you ever seen the movie Bolt? You know, little digital movie with the dog that's got superpowers, kind of thing. He's chucking this this explosive frisbee or something, and it gets chucked towards the camera. And it's on a timer, so it's like it's counting down, you know, da, 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 da. And as it almost hits the camera, it hits the 33-second mark, and then shoots away again. It's like, I don't know if it means anything, or if I'm just seeing something that's not there, or if I'm just starting to go crazy, or maybe. It's all there. It's all there for a purpose, and I'm just happened to be picking up on it because I'm looking for it.
So, Vinny, before you came on, we were discussing in the new Batman how before the big explosion in the Coliseum or the stadium, it zooms in on this window and it shows you 322 below the man in the window, which is, as we know, the Skull and Bones number, which is just, because so that's a sink. You know, you have his grandfather found Skull of Bones in the story, and then here you have 322 below the window, really emphasized.
Yeah. Well, wait. So let's just back up a second. So ultimately, what we have to figure out, I feel like our job is to use some discernment and say, what is a synchronicity and what is not? By the way, Vinny, you were confused last time. This is the official show. Everyone welcome Vincent Eastwood of the Vinny Eastwood Show. Yay. Awesome having you, buddy. But we're just going to dive right into this because this is ultimately what we're trying to figure out. Is that so that you have one community that's saying this is all synchronicity and another community that's saying this is all conspiracy. This is planted. There's someone planted this in there. Now, I think it's very possible with a number like 322, that could be Nolan with doing a little wink and a nod to something. That's very, very possible. I'm not taking position on it one way or the other, but it seems likely that's, if you're going to zoom in on a number like that, you probably have some idea of what you're referencing. It's possible that it's a total coincidence. As we know, we didn't plan for this to be episode 33, and it's funny that you've been seeing 33 all day yesterday. I don't think 33... The problem is, we're just using that as an example, is that you see in certain conspiracy circles, every time there's a number 33, someone goes, this is proof of a Masonic conspiracy. Whereas we know from a personal synchronicity level that the Masons didn't make sure you got 33 messages in your email yesterday. They didn't make sure that you saw the number 33 on your way to, you know, take a shit or something.
Oh, yeah. I just happen to look at my clock when it's 33 minutes past the hour or 33 seconds past the minute and stuff like that. I just happen to be doing it. I remember one time I was going to bed. I normally sometimes... if I've got like lots of videos to do, I'll leave one processing overnight, so it counts down certain minutes. And on my way to bed, there's the washing machine that counts down, you know, a certain amount of minutes. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just check how many minutes my video's got to process. 33 minutes, okay. And then I was walking back to bed, past the washing machine. How many minutes is it until my washing is finished? 33 minutes. And, you know. It's like, are you fucking with me?
So this is my point, though, because when you feel that, are you fucking with me? That experience, I think, is what we are collectively feeling on a grand scale. The fact that this Sandy Hook image in Batman has become such a popular thing to dissect, and everyone's looking at this as a proof of some sort of conspiracy. And what I'm saying is that within the synchromystic circles, this isn't even that big a deal. I see weirder stuff than this on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. The fact is, if someone pointed this out to me as a synchronicity, I'd chuckle and move on with my life. I don't see it as that big a deal. However, what this does tell me is that on a mass scale, as more of these things are noticed, are people ready for them? If they're going to say, are you fucking with me? If that's the response to seeing a number 33 or seeing the word Sandy Hook in one frame of a movie, if this is the reaction, are people ready for the high weirdness that comes with these type of research?
Well, here's another thing. I watch a lot of movies. It's obscene the amount of movies that I watch, from a day-to-day basis. I just consuming. And there are things that they happen so often that you begin to be suspicious that it's even possible that it's coincidence. Like, for example, when was the last time you were walking around and you saw a black and white tiled Masonic floor? Just in your day-to-day existence. And I haven't seen one in years. In fact, the last time I saw a black and white tiled floor is when I was in the largest Masonic lodge in New Zealand. Well, second largest, sorry. And the thing is, when I'm watching films, it doesn't matter whether they're from Lionsgate Productions or... 20th Century Fox or Warner Brothers or Paramount or Columbia or any number of film studios, I'm always looking for black and white tiled floors. And sure enough, there they are. In every single movie that I watch, or almost every single movie, it's actually very rare for me to watch a film and not notice a black and white tiled Masonic floor. Now, is it coincidence that every single film that's made by every single movie company in somewhere has a black and white tiled Masonic floor? Are they that popular? Is every single director that obsessed with making sure that there's a bit of a set in every single film that has something like that? It's beyond a joke. And I think is, when you want to prove something conclusively, You can't, especially with that. But there are things that are a hell of a lot more suspicious, like a film called Street Kings with Keanu Reeves. And the premise of this film is that there's these two cops who are hired cop killers. And Keanu Reeves is trying to find out who these people are. And he goes to their apartment, and they're upstairs. As he's walking up the stairs, right in the middle of the frame, there's many, many of these lampshades, and they're all identical lampshades throughout the apartment and going up the stairwells as well. And on one of those lampshades, only one of them, but it's right as he's ascending the staircase, about to find out who these cop killers are, there is a Masonic all-seeing eye on top of a pyramid done in black magic marker on the lampshade as they're ascending the staircase directly in the center of the frame. There is no possibility that that wasn't deliberately put in there, because nobody who is a filmmaker has things in their frame that are that obvious by accident, particularly in the center of the frame. It has been put there deliberately. Who directed it? I can't remember. You know, why exactly are they putting it in there? Well, my friend Freighter X, who is a member of 9 secret societies, has told me that it's actually specific that they have indeed infiltrated Hollywood in order to what he called influence society by putting and inserting Masonic symbolism into the culture in order to kind of take control of it, sort of thing. I'm not sure what his research and things like that is, but it's just, if you want to get paranoid, there's more than enough things out there to be paranoid about. See, me personally, I'll just, you know, see stuff like that and just go, eh. And it's not proof, you know. Proof is like an admission. So if somebody says, I admit that I put that Masonic all-seeing eye and pyramid in that film, that for me qualifies as proof. The fact that I see it, and nothing's really talked about it in any way, shape, or form. You know, you listen to the DVD commentary, and that scene comes and goes, and the director doesn't mention anything about it or whatever. You just don't know. And if you don't know, in my opinion, you really shouldn't care, because so many people waste their lives, literally waste their entire existence, fuddling around with all these little details, thinking that they mean something, and they instead of actually having real meaning and purpose to their own lives.
Sure, yeah. And I think the other thing that you have to realize is that these symbols are so universal that it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an affiliation to Masonry. On the first volume of the Sync book, Justin put, so you know there are 33 vertebrae in the human spine, right? So this number is not just, you know, a Masonic number. This is a human number. So on the spine of the first volume of the Sync book, Justin put 33 little dashes going up it to say this is the spine of the book. And I'm going to, you know, make a reference to the human spine and just sort of playing with it. Now, that's, of course, a knowing little jab at the people who are looking for something, but it's also a legitimate reference to something that, hey, I think this is interesting. So, you know, what we have to realize is with artists, you might be influenced by something you see going down the street. I might pass, I might hear a conversation at a party and go, oh, that's really interesting the way that those two people interacted, and I might insert that into a script. Or I might learn something about an esoteric school and say, that's a really fascinating thing. Let me put a detail from that. That doesn't mean that I hold some sort of allegiance to that esoteric school. It doesn't mean I'm a member of that society. It doesn't mean I have some grand agenda. So we have to realize, and I'm speaking first person, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm doing that, but I'm saying, whoever is doing that, that doesn't necessarily mean some sort of affiliation. And even if it does, like if I see someone in a movie, someone walking around with a crucifix, I don't get freaked out. Oh my God, they're part of some sort of Catholic conspiracy or Christian conspiracy to promote Christianity in movies. You know, if I see a character wearing a yarmulke, we don't go, oh, look, there. Well, I guess there are some people who freak out. Look, it's the Jews who run Hollywood. But I think anyone with some common sense doesn't freak out about that. I'm saying is, if you saw a character with a religious affiliation in a movie, you don't automatically assume that that director or that writer or that prop master or anybody is trying to shove something down your throat. They might be using that as an archetype or some sort of influence, obviously, but that doesn't mean that they themselves belong to that group or revere that group or that god. You know, I love when all these people freak out about the Luciferians. Like, you don't even know who Lucifer is. You can't really. And why aren't why aren't you freaking out about the quote unquote Christian conspiracy in movies? Why aren't you freaking out about the quote unquote Islamic conspiracy in movies? Why aren't you freaking out about any of these things? To see someone, even if someone said, I'm a 33rd degree Mason and I directed Star Wars. And is that any different than some guy saying, I'm a practicing Catholic and I directed, Blade Runner, whatever. Does that matter?
Well, it depends. It depends, because I've spoken to James Wright, who was the servant to the Lodge of 33rd Degree in Dallas, Texas. And every single day, he was propositioned by these married 33rd degree Masons for sex, you know? And his conclusion is that you cannot, and I think Frater X concurs with him on this, and I've spoken to a number of occult researchers, and they seem to have all been part of these orders, and they literally know what they're talking about, and they say it is not possible for you to become a ranking Freemason of the 33rd degree without either being an evil person or being open to demon possession of some description. And that's from the mouths of people who are literally in that circle. This is something that is known within those circles. Whereas the rest of us, we're on the outside. We don't know. We haven't been there. We haven't done that. Kind of like, you don't understand what it's like to be a Marine unless you've been a Marine.
Okay, but I guess what I don't get is that people automatically assume there's some validity to that. Talk about demonic possession. I don't even know, I have not seen conclusive evidence that I believe that demons exist and demonic possession exists. So, let's deal with that first.
We're talking about belief as well.
Sure.
Because they've got these really crazy belief structures in these esoteric
My point is, so does every religion. If we freaked out because some director of a movie, I'm going to use the Christian example because that's the most mainstream acceptable religion, is to say, if we found out some guy was a Christian movie director, we wouldn't freak out that he believes in some being who came from sky and died and then comes back from the dead and all this sort of stuff. We could tear that apart and go, look how weird that is. Or the fact that many Christians talk about being filled with the Spirit of Jesus. You have to open up your heart and let the Spirit of Jesus into your heart. Well, isn't that spirit possession? So we're not, on a mass scale, we're not freaking out that someone's saying, oh, these people have this crazy belief in spirit possession. They want you to be open to spirit possession. To me, that's just as strange as someone saying, Aleister Crowley saying, he took on the spirit of Ra. I don't really see a distinction between him saying he opened himself up to the spirit of Ra and some Christian housewife saying they opened themselves up to the spirit of Jesus. That's still spirit possession, whatever, however you want to label it. And if and that's their belief, is that that's okay and that's actually the ideal. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do we label which spirits are good spirits and which spirits are bad spirits seems to come prepackaged with that belief system.
It depends. If you're a 33rd degree Freemason, according to James Wright, you're propositioning people for sex all the time. And if you go against them, they stalk you, try to kill you. And there's much documented evidence of that.
Mm.
If you're a Christian who's got the spirit of Jesus, you help out in your community and you do childcare and bake sales and stuff like that. that, as opposed to
sacrifice. Right, but they're not.
You know, like you bake cookies for the kids as opposed to sacrificing them, kind of thing. That's how you know whether or not one's good or evil.
You're making a distinction, though. You're making a distinction between the Christians who are community Christians who are on that level. I mean, there's
we're talking about two extremes. Yeah, yeah.
That side of masonry.
Yeah, yeah.
And then also you're speaking of the infiltration of Hollywood. I mean, a lot of those people were the founders of Hollywood who were high up Masons. But then at the same time, you look at Proofs of a Conspiracy by John Robinson from the late 1700s. He talks about the infiltration of Masonry itself by the Illuminati. And have you heard of this?
The infiltration of Freemasonry is actually something that Fredericks is writing a book about as we speak. It's called The Secret War Inside Freemasonry.
I've heard that book is going to come out through Sync Book Press, actually. That's what I hear.
And
they do great work, I hear.
Well, see, I mean, when you're talking to somebody who's literally like a master of nine different esoteric orders, you know, you're talking about someone with knowledge far beyond any of our scope, because he has access to all of these libraries with dusty tomes like in Lord of the Rings and stuff like that, sitting down there reading away via candlelight with one of those little things, and it's just kind of like it's actually quite funny and quite spooky at the same time, that if Freemasonry used to be about men expanding other men, okay, being in contact with mentors and these sorts of things, and now it's been taken over by this other Masonic order called the Scottish Rite, which actually in many ways doesn't equate to almost any real form of Freemasonry as it was. And instead now, whenever anybody wants to talk about Freemasonry or whatever, who are the people that come on as the commentators? Who are the people who the public see on the History Channel as the ones who are Freemasons? It's always the Scottish Rite, the 33rd to 32nd degree or something like that. You know, the York Rite doesn't seem to be known about, and people don't know about all of these different orders. And in New Zealand, this country is basically founded 100% by Freemasonry. Every single town and city, first thing you see when you come into pretty much any New Zealand town or city is a sign with a Freemason symbol saying indicating that there's a lodge nearby with some kind of spire. And, you know, of course, you know they put that there, and in the center of most towns as well, there's some kind of Masonic pillar. In the centre of Auckland City, there's a hill called One Tree Hill. It used to have a tree on it, but some dude cut it down. And next to the tree, there's this, Masonic pillar. And it's on a block of land that is owned by the New Zealand Freemasons that is 330 acres. So 33. You know, There's certain things that are obvious, and other things that are esoteric and maybe coincidental that you don't know, and I think, you know, the esoteric is all about accepting possibility rather than jumping to conclusions and saying that it's a fact.
Well, morals and dogma, and all through the whole thing, everything it's mostly synchronicity. So go through that book, connects to this, connects to this, connects to this, and extrapolate information from how they connect. I have my Morals and Dogma open right here, and I love how on the first page, it says, esoteric book for Scottish Rite use only, to be returned upon withdrawal or death of recipient. And that's the newest ones that you'll find don't actually have that anymore, which I find interesting. You can find a copy of this book on eBay at this point. I think it's really noteworthy that it's not up until, 10 years ago that it's available to general people. Like, I can hold a copy of my hand, never having participated at all in Masonry, though I have lots of friends who have done quite a bit of that. But I think that there's something to be said for the information age in which we live, the fact that we can just look this stuff up. And for the longest time, I mean, even with the Bible, I mean, like, people weren't able to have access to the fucking Bible until relatively recently as well, when you look at the scope of things, you know? And so literacy is one thing, but then the question is so readily accessible is something else. But this is all stated, these synchronicities are stated as intentionalized facts throughout Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which is not taking the position of no position. It's a very particular thing that they're expressing, and they emphasize that.
Well, as far as like secrets, I think today it's all come down through history, and it's best expressed in something like the Coca-Cola Corporation, where Coca-Cola had a secret formula that, you know, was mythologized, that there's this formula, only four people know what it is, and they have it locked up in safes, in vaults, and, you know, it would all come tumbling down if that formula was, the public had access to that, that they could then go out and make their own Coca-Cola. I think all of this stuff needs to be seen through the lens of Crowley's chapter, Onion Peelings, that there's just layers and layers and layers, and that there are layers to 33 degree Masons. There's probably, you know, asshounds out there that got into it for the sex, and they got their card and they carried around to all the lodges, doing what they do. But, you know, they might serve a purpose for some other layer that's either trying to, you know, take advantage of them, or some layer that's inside, you know, above. And, you know, to try to make this a linear explanation is just to not get the central tenet of all of this area of research. All of this shit plays off another level. It's all relative. And it's how can you exploit it for power? And I think that you just boil it down there. Are you doing it for the good of the common man? Are you doing it for the good of yourself? And you can almost essentially boil it all down, all, you know, white magic or black magic, into that kind of domain. And so, I mean, I love Frederick's. I do. Don't get me wrong. I think he speaks, he backs up what he says. He's, but I mean, when I hear nine secret societies, I mean, no offense to him, but that just, it sounds kind of funny to me.
Well, nine different esoteric orders. Yeah, exactly. And I've got the whole conclusion that the reason Freight is a part of so many of these different secret orders is because he's got such a massive thirst for knowledge. Like, the amount of books that he consumes on a daily, weekly basis, you know, would blow the minds of most illiterate Americans and New Zealanders. But and he's just told me the stories of how he loves to go into these archives of these lodges everywhere, and nobody ever goes down to these archives, right? There's just thousands and thousands upon books down there that none of the Masons in the lodge have looked at in 100+ years, kind of thing, you know, like old dusty.
Right, because no one cares anymore.
Nobody cares.
Right, that's why I think that's part of the proof of, I think, the position that these Masons aren't part of some grand occult mystery, is they've actually forgotten their mystery school teachings. Many of them are interested in the business contacts. How can I get more business for my plumbing company? Oh, I become a Mason.
How can I get away from my wife a couple of nights a week?
Right, something like that. So, you know, and then maybe you do the bake sale, maybe you do what, you know, some local charity work or something. But if you're not going down into the basement and reading the book, then you're not, you don't even know that there is an occult something or other. You know, I know. Go ahead.
The Freemasons, for me, and I could be completely wrong about this, were master builders, just quite simply. So they didn't need to rely upon any outside agency to construct houses. So when we went from nomadic cultures to agricultural cultures, you needed to have buildings to live in, and especially if you wanted to expand into territories where weather conditions made it impossible to live in. So you had a sort of union of builders that had strength in numbers, that these fringe people who had knowledge, that kept getting destroyed by vandals and invaders and rapers and pillagers, they said, we need to keep this knowledge alive. So they found a way to integrate themselves into the Freemasonic Corporation, if you will, because they had numbers, they had structures, they had food to survive, you know, droughts, famines, whatnot. They had armies to protect themselves from these tribal groups that lived out on the outskirts of agricultural society. And they just said the only place for Freemasonry is a hard drive, and you could preserve information within it. And it's almost like a virus that saw, or a parasite that saw a place to protect itself so it could transmit knowledge down history. And that's what all this stuff is. You can build a library, but the library can be burned. And then how do the people who don't know the sum total of that knowledge begin to rebuild a library? They said, fuck this. We can't think about ourselves. We need to find a way to transmit knowledge down to our spiritual children who might be 5, 6, 7 generations away. And they found places like Freemasonry to do this because you couldn't do it with the church. The church would destroy the information.
Yeah.
Because the church wanted to put the pause button on history. And so that's why you have all this deep, powerful esoteric wisdom in Freemasonry, because it was sort of like the indie scene or the underground scene. It was outside of the church, and they knew that, hey, fuck, you want to use our basement to store some books? That's cool, man. You're a brother, you know? And that's how I think the whole thing worked. That's my interpretation.
My father-in-law is a very deeply religious Christian man, and is also a brilliant engineer. So he has this like really strong scientific mind and also this really strong Christian faith, right? So it's interesting to see how that plays out. It's actually given me a whole new insight into that sort of world. But it's interesting because we were talking one night and we were just like walking. It was late at night and we hooked up with the moon. And he goes, you know, I don't understand how it took people so long to figure out how the moon moves and where it is in space. He's like, it was like, you know, common sense to his like mathematical brain. He's like, it's obviously a sphere. It moves through space. He's like, I don't understand why people for so long couldn't figure this stuff out. And I was like, well, let me explain it to you. You go back to biblical times, and the guy next to you says, I think maybe that moon moves around like this. And you watch everyone around you throw stones at him and beat him to death. And then suddenly you shut the fuck up. And you go, you know what? I'll just keep that thought to myself. Because if you're in an age where you can't say, you know, these are ages where you couldn't dissect human cadavers to study anatomy, so you have to guess, or you have to go into the basement and cut up bodies, and then you're suddenly that creepy black magic guy who's cutting up dead bodies. Well, maybe you just want to understand anatomy, and you're not allowed to do it. So all these things where if you watch the people around you getting stoned to death for even suggesting that things are different, suddenly you shut the hell up. And if you meet someone else who's also like you, you know, you kind of, hey, psst, I'll meet you down the hall next Thursday, and maybe we can talk about that big glowing ball in the sky.
I've always found that funny, and this conversation reminds me of a calendar that I saw on my dad's batch one time, and it has the days, and it also has a fish symbol of varying filled out degrees, like the fishing's going to be so good this day and that day and that day. And I was like, how the hell did they determine, like, in a calendar, like a year in advance, what the fishing's going to be like on a particular day? Did they get some like real old salty sea dog motherfuckers just to sit down there and, you know, I reckon that. What the fuck?
We might know the mating schedule of fish, you know, to some degree of when they, I don't know, culminate or whatever. Maybe, I don't know.
Well, yeah, see, and again, farmers, the point is that we've got so many things out there that appear official, but we don't understand. Official, that's a pun there. And that appear official that we don't even know exactly how they came to that kind of thing. Have you noticed that we don't understand anything around us? Like this, for example. This is a megaphone. I have no fucking idea how this thing works. I could, if you put, like, what was his name? Like Joe Rogan said, you know, you could stick me away in a forest for 1,000 years trying to figure out how to make a cell phone, and I wouldn't be able to do it. Have you noticed how we're so detached from real knowledge these days?
Yes.
All right. And even simplicity. Like I was talking about this with my producer's wife the other day. I said, we don't know anything, okay? We really don't know anything. You have a look at this apple tree here. We don't even know how to define exactly what an impact just a simple apple tree will have. How many fruits will it bear? I don't know. How much nutrition will it actually return to the soil by the result of those fruits that are uneaten, that drop? I don't know. How many birds nest on that tree? I don't know. We don't understand anything, even down to the minutiae, about anything really. And it's made me really, really humble, and my conclusion is I really don't know anything, and very few people really do know anything about anything. Think it's part of our human society that we try to make sense of these things because we're not comfortable with being uninformed fools.
Oh, yeah. And I think this is why the temptation's there to take a hard-line position, is to feel like you know something, because it's really scary sometimes to know how little you know. You know, the exact what you're talking about, this idea of if you spent 1,000 years in a forest, could you come with a cell phone? No. And even if you could, you wouldn't know that it worked. Let's say you hit on the right combination of cell phone, you wouldn't know if it worked if there was no cell phone tower anymore, right? So maybe you built it, but it doesn't work. So you have no idea that it works. I was thinking about this, like the idea of like this sort of, whether it be ancient aliens or some sort of really advanced society from 1 billion years ago or, you know, whatever, just sort of entertaining these thoughts. And I was like, just look at how we have it, where we used to have cassette tapes and now, you know, we had like all our media was on something physical. And now more and more we go to a digital media and even like things like cloud computing. So it's basically traps out there floating in some digital cloud, or maybe it's on a hard drive somewhere, or maybe it's whatever. Now, let's say you take our current society, you know, drop an atomic bomb or an ice age or something on it, or, you know, destroy this, and then people are trying to rebuild their cell phones. How would there be enough people that would remember how to do it, how to use it? Maybe the infrastructure is not there anymore. And then maybe you don't even have the evidence that it existed. This is just, bear in mind, just entertaining ideas. But something like, if you've gotten rid of all your, you know, tangible, like, here's my hard drive. Oh, I don't need a hard drive anymore. Now it's on a flash drive. Now it's on this little microchip. Now it's on some, you know, digital newosphere, essentially. Once those things are gone, what evidence do you have to come back? And then even if you did, again, like I give the cell phone example, how do you even know if it works? So maybe we could have had iPhones 1 billion years ago, but if you had an iPhone 1 billion years ago, but no more cell phone towers, for all intents and purposes, you have a crappy piece of plastic nothing.
Yeah, well, and some would argue that an iPhone is a crappy piece of plastic nothing in and of
itself. I don't have one. I don't have one.
Oh, yeah.
For your next birthday, Alan, I'm getting you an iPhone. Phenomenal.
Have you noticed how people they choose to reject certain information because they just don't like it, they're uncomfortable with it or whatever. They refuse to look into it or listen to anybody who spouts about it. Like I had a Christian guy on my show yesterday, and we talked about Alex Jones for an hour, and then we talked about aliens and demonology for the second hour. You know, me, I don't know about you guys, but I just like to put my finger in as many pies as possible. Just I like the flavors. One of my listeners in the chat room says, Vinny, why are you even entertaining this guy? And I was like, it is a show, isn't it? Isn't entertaining people the name of the game?
I think even just for our own personal education, like I know, even doing these sync books, you know, or now doing these radio shows, I have people on who I disagree with, but I want to, again, not entertain, your pun is well appreciated, but the idea of I want to consider their thoughts. Even if I disagree with them, all the more reason that I should at least consider their position and figure out, well, does that make sense? Do they have a convincing argument? And is there something there that maybe, even if I only agree with 5% of it, maybe I've learned something? I think this is what we need to be doing is, you know, that crazy guy spouting on the corner, let's listen to him for a few minutes, figure out if there's something there. And the, you know, scientist who works for CNN, we might say, we don't want to just completely throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, oh, he got a job for a government agency, he's obviously full of shit. Well, maybe he's not. Maybe he came across something that's valuable, but he's working for something that's part of the control system. Like, let's at least entertain different pieces of information, and this is where the onus is on us to, you know, try and distinguish, again, what's synchronicity, what's conspiracy, what's intentional, what's unintentional, what is valuable, what's not. What information can we disregard? What information should we carry that has some sort of value to us? Maybe we should learn how to build megaphones. Maybe, you know, maybe that's more important than figuring out, you know, what Batman's grandfather was doing in a TV show. yeah, I mean, these are like, we should be trying to educate ourselves as much as possible.
Uncomfortable. I think people tend to get uncomfortable with something not taking either position or just the energetic of being open to things. Like, I don't know, it's like with the masonry thing, it just seems like it's so much easier to call it insidious or to say that these people have had nothing but the best intentions for humanity forever and that they're the keepers of the light or this or that, and not the idea that you know, the idea that within these groups, there's so many people wanting a different outcome and want it. I don't think these people are all in agreement. That's absurd. That feels to me absurd to assume that these people are all on the same.
And we could probably say the same
thing, you know,
most things
the same for like the CIA, right? Like not sure. Everyone in the CIA has the same agenda. I'm not trying to give a free pass to the CIA. I'm just saying,
oh, it's just my favorite. One of my favorite words of all time is compartmentalization. You know, I mean, look at it this way.
Sure.
To say that somebody who works in the CIA as an agent knows everything that the CIA is doing is saying that a person who's a clerk at Macca's who just got employed is somehow knows exactly what's on the CEO's mind and could do his job for somehow if he died tomorrow. No. Everybody got different roles, different parts to play, and I can guarantee any organization that I've ever worked for, nobody on the front ground floor or whatever has any fracking clue what the founder of the company or the current CEO of the company is thinking or doing. Not a clue. Okay, they've got these training protocols. You can imagine what they train people at Macca's with. We've served over a billion people. We want to get people something that's fast and yummy and da, 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 and all these positive things. They don't tell them there's about 1,000 cows per beef patty. They don't tell them the cheese is one chemical compound away from polyurethane. They don't tell, you know, they don't tell them any of these things. And I doubt that they even tell the CEO this, you know. There'll be certain people within the organization that may know that or may know that, right, or whatever. But connecting the dots, on the other hand, is an entirely different story. Somebody being part of an organization and fulfilling a role is completely different from somebody being part of an organization and understanding how their role fits in and plays out with the entirety of the organization. Two very different things.
Right. They can be a useful idiot, right?
I think most people are useful idiots.
In fact, no,
I rephrase. I think most people are useless idiots.
that's what I was thinking, yeah.
Well, useful to somebody else's plan. See, that's the thing, is that there's so much pride that goes into any position up the whole ladder. At every rung, somebody has pride in their job. I've known people who are proud of the shittiest jobs imaginable, yet because they gain a certain identity from their role, they're also the energetic of people feeling like they must be in the know if they've been given this title. So all the whole way up, like you say CEOs, I totally, you know, it doesn't seem like just because you got whatever, you know, label you've worked so hard to achieve that you're privy to everything that's going on. Like, to me, this is a thing, like, people talk about the 9/11 agenda. When I see Bush's face in that video of him with the pet goat, he looks fucking clueless and scared. He's like, oh shit, what did they do? Like, it doesn't, he doesn't look like he's some mastermind. He I think he knows a bit, but he's a total useful idiot, as far as I can tell, like, or he was, you know.
Well, I think Bush was just a useless idiot, personally. That's my opinion. But I employment in general, I call it having a slave job. And some of my listeners have caught on with this term, and they, you know, I'll get messages on Skype, like, hey, Vinny, I just got back from my slave job, and they're just such scum. And I got this idea, man, that if you don't really have a choice, if you don't really, really have a choice, then you're a slave. Like, let's say, for example, your choice is arrive, get up earlier than you want to, forcibly with an alarm, get stuck in traffic for an hour, go to a job you hate working with people who are douchebags who don't really give a fuck about you, or you're on the street. You're a slave. You know, you don't there's no real choice there. And the same with government. You know, did you volunteer to pay your taxes? No.
Are dogs and cats slaves?
Huh?
Are dogs and cats and all house pets, are they slaves?
I guess they are. Really?
You just asked that question as my cat jumped up on my lap.
Wonderful.
Your slave cat.
Your cat.
Is my cat what?
Your cat smoking a cigarette? No, I just think this is one of the most difficult arguments if one is to have, I think, a truly open and enlightened conversation about slavery, conspiracy, and all this. There was a story that came on about a woman who opened a business of bringing puppies to nursing homes or to events because they brought such joy to people. Well, you know, you're talking about a life form that is bred to specific, aesthetic degrees to please people, to be products, to be purchased. They are separated from the animality of their species, you know, because they're isolated. They're often kept in environments where they are the only one of their kind, and they are kept for human enjoyment. And people say, well, there's a bond there. And listen, I don't want to step on anyone's toes completely, but you can look at the argument. Why is it acceptable for the common person to breed, purchase, and captivate a creature for their own enjoyment, and then they rail at the government for possible conspiratorial okay, there you go.
Like let's say you own a cat, you own a dog, or you own a slave, right? I don't own Alan. I don't own the guests on American Freedom Radio that I have on or anything like that. I ain't paying them, so there's no slavery implied here with those relationships, because there's no force implied, and again, no ownership. Animals, livestock, are clearly slaves to humanity because we literally purchased them like you would a slave. Even though they have a really nice life. I mean, many slaves had great lives, I'm sure, in the Roman Empire. You know, they'd be sit there, you know, feed a few grapes to Caesar, and it's nice. And they get to live in a nice palace and stuff like that with no balls because they couldn't sleep with the harem or anything like that. And they got had to lift up their kaft hats once upon a time to feel the nice rubbing of giant stones cracking together against their nuts. So slavery itself is just as much a state of being as it is a state of mind. I remember having a conversation with a the guy who helped me to get my website, Guerrilla Media, up and running in the first place. And you have a look at Guerrilla Media and it looks like shit. And the reason it looks like shit is because the guy who helped me to do it was a slave in the mind. He decided that it wasn't worth it helping out with the website anymore. It wasn't worth it, that he would much rather work for some company and make money there and keep his head down in order to avoid the coming New World Order or whatever, as he believed in Doomsday, rather than help me expose Scumbaggery and have a better platform for which to let people's voices be heard, kind of thing. And he's like, oh, you're just a slave, Vinny, you're just a slave. And I say, well, I'll tell you what, man, you're a hell of a lot more of a slave than I am, because it really is a state of mind. If I have the state of mind, I'm a slave, there's nothing I can do, and then I choose to do nothing, then I truly am a slave. If I'm a slave...
And I agree with that.
If I'm a slave right now, and I believe I'm still a slave right now, but the difference between me and, say, him, is that I don't want to be a slave, and I will fight for my freedom. I won't give in. That makes me, mentally, not a slave.
Well, just to finish the thing, yeah, I agree with you, is that a cat and a dog doesn't know what money is, doesn't know what being purchased or sold is. It doesn't have any relative understanding of what being a slave might be. It just knows it's comfortable. It knows it's loved. It's know that it's being taken care of. And no one would rise up from that, you know?
Did you ever see the George Orwell's Animal Farm, the cartoon version? I think it was like after the animals.
That was produced by the CIA,
as they say, and written by George Orwell, of course. And there was a scene in it just after the animals had had a revolution on the farm and kicked out the farmer. These birds were sent out in every direction to tell other animals about how much of a success Animal Farm had been, i.e., communism. And it says in the film that the animals, like cats who are sitting out on this porch, you know, drinking its beautiful, nice, warm saucer of milk and everything like that, would listen to the bird for a second and then reject him and say, go away, I don't care, because they have it really comfortable. But the animals who were, a bullock in the field, ploughing really, really hard every day and being whipped, listened very, very intently and accepted everything that the bird had to say about Animal Farm. And my conclusion is about life in general is that unless you suffer, you don't grow and you're not willing to listen. Really. The more comfortable we have it, the weaker we are and the more enslaved we are.
Yeah, I think these are all excellent points. I just want to quickly... say, I mean, David made a reference here to Look at All the Happy Creatures, which is a book I wrote, which is sort of like an Animal Farm type deal, where it's about animals that are in horrible conditions and are trying to revolt from this situation. And I think this is ultimately something that is very, very near and dear to my heart. I just want to throw out two things, is to say not everything is a purchased situation also. The cat that I have was an animal rescue, an animal that was going to be put to death that I rescued and welcomed into my home when I was, it was at a time when I was so broke, I wasn't sure how I was feeding myself, and I took in this other life form to help feed it. I don't see that as me taking upon ownership of an animal that's doing my best to, hey, I don't have it great, but if you want to at least live, you know, come live with me.
But what if somebody stole your cat? And you wanted it, and you wanted it back. Let's say, for example, would you say that's my cat to this person? Give it back to me.
I guess it depends what the circumstance. If someone came into my house and removed my cat without, my I mean, just the whole circumstance of someone coming into my house to do anything. What is this circumstance? So,
well, not well. Like, let's say your cat's on the street. Somebody picks him up and starts walking away with your cat.
Right. Just to say, like, my cat's an indoor cat. My friend Doug had an outdoor cat, and at some point, his cat was hanging out on his neighbor's porch for like pretty regularly. And at some point, those people moved. And they brought that cat with them. And at first he was upset, like, oh my God, they just took my cat. And he was like, well, actually, I guess it wasn't really my cat. You know, it's like that cat came here and I fed it sometimes. But he felt like a little like a jilted lover, you know, like, hey, they chose someone else over me. I think that's probably under those sort of circumstances, you might be like upset of like, oh, I really enjoyed that cat's company. That's a shame. Is completely different than, again, if someone came like into my home and, you know, removed anything from my home, I would be pretty upset for a completely different reason than...
Well, it's about the appliance of ownership. Like, again, if he actually had the phone number of those people to the new house that they moved in and he knew that they had the cat, would he have called them and say, hey, can I have my cat back? Or did he just accept that he'd lost the cat because he knew that he didn't know their number and he wouldn't be able to get it back unless he hired some kind of private investigator and just thought it wasn't worth the effort?
I think he called them and said, hey, did you notice, you know, what happened after you guys moved? What happened to the cat that always hung out on your front porch? And they're like, oh, we didn't know that was your cat. And I think they gave it to someone else, like an adoption thing or whatever they did with it. And he was like, oh, okay, at least, you know, the cat's taken care of. He didn't make an issue out of it. And
can you imagine a dude in like New York who had a cat named Django and the cat went missing and they put a sign up on a telephone pole and it said, have you seen my cat Django? Please call me, return to me. Right. I don't know. I'm spinning off on a tangent there.
I have a good friend who had a pet raccoon. And the raccoon got away. He took care of it. He found the raccoon was dying when it was very small. And he took it in. He nursed it. He did the whole thing, you know, not physically with his breast or anything. But he took care of this raccoon. It was a total tame raccoon. It got away. He had to put up signs all over the town for his raccoon. And a couple months later, or somewhere in there, a while later, he gets a call from an old woman who had taken in the raccoon. So the raccoon came to her porch and wasn't like the other raccoon. She was feeding it. It was in her house. He came over to see if it was, and sure enough, it was his raccoon, and he saw how much she loved it, and he said, you know what, keep the raccoon, whatever.
But, you need this one more than I do. I think it's compassion. When I think that's what really separates us from the animals, and maybe we infect animals with that, is just compassion for other species and other people, empathy, that kind of thing. I'm not 100% sure if there's instances of animals really either going out of their way and doing things that are against maybe natural law of nature type programming, where they will, I don't know, a lion will try to eat a baby wildebeest or something like that, and then he's chewing on its leg and the thing's crying, and he sees the wildebeest's mother, you know, getting really stressed out, and he goes, you know what, I'm sorry, you know, just dust him off, go back to your mother, I'm sorry, you know. I don't think that happens.
What was I thinking?
You know, in human society, it happens all the time. People will start doing something really, really bad, and then they'll see the consequences of their actions that other people are feeling, and they'll stop what they're doing, and they'll change their entire direction because of how somebody else feels, not because of how they feel.
Yeah.
It speaks well of us, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there are cases like, you guys remember like Coco's Kitten or something, like the gorilla that had a kitten and things like that. You remember that from the 80s? Mm. Anyway, but yeah, there's all sorts of different examples. And thank you. I'm glad someone gets my obscure references. But I think there are definitely things like, even like I had pet rats when I took in this kitten, and the idea was that if the kitten was under a certain age, then it would learn to coexist with the rodents. And if it was over a certain age, it was basically hopeless. I had done some research. And when I adopted the kitten, it was already a few weeks past that. And I tried to get them to coexist, and it didn't work. But there is something, again, this is where instinct takes over. If you can, and is that, which is more wrong? Do I try and, short circuit? If I get a kitten at a young enough age, I can say, hey, actually, you don't kill these other things.
Well, it's like the Jesuits. It's like the Jesuits who give me a boy until the age of 7 and I'll show you the man, give me a kitten until the age of 6 weeks or something and I'll show you the cat.
Yeah. So, which is more fair, to let it be like, there's all sorts of things like, the Humane Society says it's more humane to cut your cat's balls off to make sure that they don't spread, so you don't have this overpopulation issue. And I think to myself, well, I wouldn't want someone to cut my balls off, so I'm not doing that. I'm proud to say my cat still has his balls.
Well, of course, you wouldn't want somebody to put a litter of your children into a gas chamber because you can't afford to feed them either, as happens with cats. So, I think there's so many moral issues going on, wherever we look, there's always some kind of moral dilemma. And I wonder, as just kind of in general, like in quotation marks, the human race, are we even really anywhere near as moralistic or capable of caring and being nice to each other and having strong communities just in general as perhaps we once were? I mean, I was speaking to my producer and his wife the other night, and they said that air conditioning destroyed community in the south of the United States. Mm-hmm. Namely because back in the day when it was hot at night, everybody would be out sitting on their porches or taking a brief stroll or something like that to cool off. And you would pass people by on their houses and go, hey, Jethro, what's going on, man? I'm just polishing my shotgun. What's up with your family, man? And, there'd be some kind of interaction that happens by proxy out of the fact that people can't just sit indoors and remain cool. And now that they can, nobody knows even their neighbor.
I think we could also take this the step further. I think it's an excellent point, by the way. This is part joke and part harsh truth. Isn't the ultimate goal to know thyself? We're complaining we don't know our neighbors. We don't even know ourselves.
Well, and also it takes a village to raise a child, and right. often through the interaction with other people, they will teach you things about yourself. And if you're forever looking inwards, essentially what you're doing is you're limiting outward influence, and the more outward influence you limit to yourself, the more you're limiting just yourself in general, kind of like every person that you meet rubs off on you in some way and influences you in some way. So, for instance, me, I hang out with people of all walks of life of different areas of research. My friend Jono was, whatever your social circle you hang out with determines kind of which part of your personality you take from them or they take from you, vice versa. And I was just thinking to myself, all these people that I talk to, all these guests that I interview, basically some of the top thinkers of our time, in my opinion. So in so doing, I'm being told fairly regularly sometimes when I go on other people's shows that I'm very wise and all of this kind of stuff. And it's of no surprise to me that I've become a lot wiser, because all of the people that I interact with, I feel that in some part are wiser than me in certain areas. And so thus I grow.
Yeah, very well said. So it's such a pleasure to get to do this. This sort of work, whatever you want to call this, is a really weird little honor, because you get to interact with so many people that are doing something different or thinking different things, who've researched, maybe, even if you want to say they haven't researched more than me, but they've researched something different than you, or whatever. No one's egos here. but just to say, so everyone's diving into their own little rabbit holes, doing their own brand of research, coming at it from their perspectives. And by sharing all these things, I really do feel like we're all hopefully getting a lot wiser by being able to share these thoughts and different perspectives and things like that. It's hugely rewarding, personally.
Well, the experiment of America was the grand experiment. It was, I think, all the most intelligent people recognizing that there needed to be an arena for all the cultures to congregate, and that's the melting pot. It's the alchemical fire that takes everything from every direction and tries to create the agent which would take the old world into the future, because they recognized that with borders and kingdoms and nations, there was a logjam. It wasn't going to go anywhere. So the internet now is the child of that experiment. This is a pure thinking melting pot where you can have conversations that, even if they go into the most vile and violent kind of attacks, you can't shoot them from across the screen. You can't hurt them. There's a simmering that takes place that allows the thoughts to get past that emotional infancy and for ideas to start really interacting with each other. This is the whole concept of the meme, you know, that these are the genetic components that we're freeing and sending out into the thought stream via the internet, and they're combining. And
continue.
Well, no, it's just that we're on the cusp of a genesis of a new way of interacting that is what I conceive of as the star child at the end of 2001. It's the synthesis of everything, but it's genetic and it's mathematical and it's malleable. And it allows us to consider things from 360 degrees of interpretation, but to actually come to make it into something that we can actually use, you know, that's the thing, that you could actually apply it. That's why all these applications are in smartphones. We're searching for the ultimate application. You know, religions were just different forms of applying wisdom and trying to instruct people. Shows like this, the fact that you're in New Zealand, and that, you know, Alan's in Virginia, David's in California, I'm in Chicago. The fact that it cost us pennies today to get this dialogue going, where before not only would it have taken thousands and thousands of dollars, it would have taken months, maybe years, for all of us to travel into one location to share this memetic material. But we're doing it instantly today. So this event, the moment that we realized we existed, that we thought a certain way, this event should have taken place 5 years from now, but it's taking place today. That's the time machine that the internet provides. We transcend space and time to get to the heart of the matter. So, like, I don't know, right now, the only political thing that scares me would be the shutting down of the internet. Or the only economic thing that scares me is if the prices of the internet skyrocket up, but yet they seem to be going down. So I don't know.
You see something positive coming out, you know?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Another thing that I found about the internet is that people have a separation socially from the consequences of their actions. Have you noticed how people almost have no qualms about being real rude and saying mean and hurtful things on the internet because they know that there aren't going to be any consequences to their actions by saying that?
Fuck you, Vinny. You're an asshole. Vinny, I hate you.
No, like you get these YouTube comments or Facebook comments and things like that, and the people are just like mindless brain spasms who throw out all this insult and things like that. Whereas, have you ever heard the term "say that to my face"? You know,
right.
People are too cowardly to say things to their face, And also, conversely, you can say things to people in an email or online or whatever, and if it's written down, the tone of the voice is taken out of it. The vein of communication and the intention in which it's said can sometimes be lost. So I could perhaps say, this happened to me with Dr. Judy Wood. You know, I like Dr. Judy Wood and Where Did the Towers Go and all of this kind of stuff. And she was supposed to be scheduled to come on the show one day. And she was being a kind of a bit difficult because I'd messed up and I was trying to accommodate her and just like, and she kept just repeating something, and I was like, are you a bit tired? Out of genuine concern, and she took that as an insult and has never spoken to me since. And I got an email from a friend of hers threatening to sabotage my show and prevent me from getting guests like Max Kaiser and Jesse Ventura, who are personal friends of those, and I'll never be a professional radio show host if I go around insulting people and never contact me again. So this person took one thing that I said that was said with good intentions, blows it totally out of proportion, and indeed I have to deal with consequences for the rest of my career because I cared about somebody and they didn't care enough to ask me what I meant by something because they didn't hear the tone of my voice.
Yeah, I think that's so hard, is to all these things, right? Sarcasm, intent, you know, just again, there's no, the taking the tonality out of it really does a hard, puts a hardship on it, because there's so many of the finer emotions that you can't express. And I've had fights with my wife over something. You know, she sent me a text message, oh, we're supposed to meet somewhere, send me a text message, and then I respond to something, and it's like, all right, I have 100 characters to express something. I'm sorry I didn't express it as eloquently as possible. Or vice versa, you know, where I'm thinking, why is she being like that? It's a text message, you know. You can't, you're reading into it what you think. There's no tonality, there's no context very often. It's very, very difficult. And I think this is, you know, I make this point, I think, on last week's show, saying, what can you even do? You add a smiley face? Like, our best thing is we're like emoticons, where you know, if you put a smiley face, are you a bit tired? Smiley face. Would she know that you were joking, or would that be more insulting because she thinks you're making fun of her, you're having fun at her, you know, all these things you can't do. It's hard enough sometimes having a conversation like this.
How dare you emoticon me like that, you motherfucker?
Did you use the winking smiley face? Oh, I hate that one.
So, you know, I think it's like... People are really, really, you kind of choose what you interpret from what other people say in a lot of cases. Me, personally, I choose to interpret what people say as positive until it's obviously not. You know what I'm saying? And that way, 99% of my conversations wind up being positive, because 99% of the time I'm being communicated with, and of course, 99% of statistics are made up. most of the interactions that I have with people wind up being positive because I deliberately, intentionally interpret the things that they say as coming from a good, pure, and decent place. And as a result, I have very few toxic relationships. There are other people out there, on the other hand, who I will speak to who will not interpret the things that I say in the same way that I would interpret the things they say, and they get angry at me for absolutely no reason.
Aren't you just interpreting that they've interpreted for no reason? Maybe they feel like they have a reason, maybe.
Well, the thing is, I'll say something really nice to somebody and they fly into a rage and never talk to me again.
Yeah.
You know, it's when you're dealing with that kind of stuff, it's like you just wish sometimes that people would just accept you, or that people would get you, and that you wouldn't have to pussyfoot around, you wouldn't have to preface everything that you say and you wouldn't have to explain after you've said something what you meant by what you said. If somebody would just automatically think positively and accept what you've got to say, then your communications, I believe, become much more efficient because you don't have to fuck around assuming that somebody might be insulting me.
What I think you're talking about, Vinny, used to be known as road rage, and it was best illustrated. When you'd be out in the road, encased in your little metal box, driving, if a certain mindset would allow you to interpret people's actions on the road. You might think the guy's an asshole trying to cut you off, but maybe there's somebody in the passenger side who's sick and they're trying to get to the hospital, or they're racing to get or who knows. But people, road rage became that sort of minority, very ego-driven, this motherfucker is fucking with me, that makes them a shithead, I'm going to try to run them off the road. When there was that sort of narrative never existed outside of the confines of that automobile. And I think once they were able to put a name on it, road rage, people became conscious of it. And I think that the absolute ridiculous kind of fatalities that emerged out of this sort of ego-driven telekinesis of understanding what is happening went down. So I think with YouTube or comments on the internet, once people came up with the name of trolling and or that kind of thing, people were able to kind of have a firmer grasp on identifying what kind of comments they should put stock in and which kind of comments they could kind of eliminate. So I think that the precursor to internet communication was this car language, you know, that everyone consciously or unconsciously was reading every time they were out in the road. Internet language is a type of language. I think when you really get to know someone, when you really have a firm dialogue that extends over a period of time, which oddly enough, you might spend more time getting to know somebody on the internet than you ever did in your real life, you know, acquaintances that you might believe are friends. The fact that we can accurately communicate via just words on a screen, where you can pick up inflections of sarcasm or inflections of, hey, are you doing okay? And you could make that that leap to understanding and read through the script. It's there if you want it, if you have that sort of connection with the person. And that's sort of the triumph of spirit over matter, in that it can actually bleed through the screen. So
I was just thinking about this.
I don't know, growing pains, you know?
Well, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, if I was to ever run for politics, and I probably never will, there'd be a couple of ways that I might want to do it. Like, firstly, I might want to run as a member of the clown party and dress up in a big clown outfit, you know, red nose, rainbow wig, giant shoes and stuff like that, and go, vote for me, everybody. I'm way less corrupt than the rest of these clowns. And the the second way of doing it would be, don't vote for me, ladies and gentlemen. I will not solve your problems. Don't vote for any of the other people on this platform either. They won't solve your problems. Instead of going out and waiting in line for 4 hours to a voting booth for a system that doesn't give a fuck about you, go talk to a random stranger and be nice to them and try to do something for them that they can't do for themselves. You become the government, okay? Good vibes and courtesy between strangers, I think, is a far more powerful political tool than any amount of legislation and force at the barrel of a gun. It's the good little things that people do for each other just because it's the right thing to do that really keep the evil at bay. And even so much as yesterday, I don't know. Sometimes when I'm driving, I go away with the fairies and I change lanes without thinking about it or whatever. And I think it's like when you're indicating to get into somewhere, the person has a choice whether or not to let you in, whether or not to slow themselves out and to slow down their journey in order to let you in. And when you're driving, you're limited to extremely simple communication. So you've got your indications and the things that are actually mechanical. But if you're having some kind of a human interaction, it's usually hand signals like a thumbs up or a wave or something of that nature. And I got let in twice, even though I fucked up kind of while driving, these people actually kind of slowed down and let me into the traffic and things like that. And I'd give them a wave, and they give me a bit of a wave, and it actually made me feel good. Like, it made me feel really good, not only to be let in, but also to acknowledge that person for doing so, and for them to acknowledge me back and to accept my thanks to them, you know? And that happened two or three times. And usually I'll be the one who's doing that for other people when I'm driving around. I'll see somebody who's trying to cross the street, and one side of the traffic is just non-existent, and the other side of the traffic is just completely just bumper to bumper. There's no way this person's ever going to be able to turn into this little side bay without somebody literally taking the initiative to put on the brakes for a little bit, allow traffic to back up for just a second, so that one person doesn't have to sit there for 5 minutes waiting for a little break. And I'm normally that person. I slow down, flash my lights at them, and let them go through, because I understand that only a tiny little thing, just a tiny little thing, a little bit of courtesy can really mean a lot to somebody. It can give them a lot of good vibes. And it's just courtesy between strangers, I think, is one of my favorite things really to do in life. I remember, what was it? You know Dickie's clothing? You know Dickie's workwear, yeah. Stuff like that, jeans and all that? Well, the son of the CEO of Dickie's New Zealand, I met on the street, and he had been giving out free Dickie's clothing on the main street of Auckland, New Zealand. You know, just free clothing. Somebody comes up to him, he's like, yeah, have a pair of jeans, have a t-shirt, have this, have that, the other. And somebody fucking mugged him and took all the clothes off of him, right? And stole his weed and his wallet. Oh, here, all right? And I had a joint in my pocket and $10. And I gave it to him so he could get a taxi home and have a smoke so that he wouldn't have to feel quite so bad about that. So I was able to destroy what could have potentially been a terrible experience for him that would have manifested a hate and a fear of just general people around him, simply by taking the initiative. I can help this person. And because I chose to, he was so overwhelmingly overjoyed, despite the fact that he'd been mugged.
I think if people walked around the street handing out joints to people in tough situations, this world would be a better place. Hell yeah. I need to put the brakes on this conversation for a second, because it's actually a really funny segue to trying to bring someone else in or let someone else in. I have a guy on Skype right now. Vinny, he actually contacted you. This gentleman is from France. His name is Guillaume. He had contacted you and suggested me as a guest on your radio show. This gentleman, his name is Guillaume. He had apparently contacted you, said, hey, you should have Alan on your show. And that worked out that way. And he and I have actually never spoken. And while we were doing this call, he hit me up on Skype and said, hey, are you around to talk? And I said, well, actually, it's funny you should ask. I'm talking to Vinny. Maybe we'll bring you in later in the show. So I told him to hold off a little bit, but I think we're about an hour and a half in. I want to just kind of bring him into the call if no one else minds. See if we can get him in here. And
well, I think this is a nice segue, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I love conversations that are free form. Have you ever, I don't know how to say this, but it's something like forcing a good conversation to happen sometimes. You ever feel like that? Like you're the one who actually is taking the initiative to make a good conversation happen? In fact, I got criticized about that once by a friend of mine, Terry. He's no longer my friend, but he says, "Vinny, you're always trying to force good conversation on people." I was like, "Fuck, sorry, bro." Yeah. What a bastard of me.
I'm sure as a radio host, you have to do that sometimes, though. If someone's not really, you know, you have a guest on and you say, "So, tell me about such and such." And they go, "Yep, this is, got a new book out about is why it's bad that something about crop circles." You know, it's like, I need you to give me a little more than that.
Yeah. In fact, that's how I run my show format. Is it's like you just wind your guest up and let him go. And I barely even ask questions per se. I found that the best conversations aren't one where it's an interview where a person's asking the questions and asking the questions and asking the questions and things like that. I think some of the best conversations is when I ask a question of myself or make an explanation. And then the other person responds with one of theirs.
Guillaume, we need you to lower your speaker or put in headphones or something. You get an echo there.
Okay, so I'm going to try it.
All you got to do is just turn down your speakers.
Does it work like that? Is it better?
Yeah, I think that's better.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I just turned into out. You hear me now?
Yep.
Yes.
Is it okay? Fully okay? Okay, great. So.
Welcome.
Hello and welcome. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, thank you for...
It's a pleasure to be joined by you. I was saying to Vinny, it's really a funny synchronicity is that you contacted me today while I'm speaking to Vinny. You're actually the one who put us into contact with each other. And I think we just lost him. So
that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
He's got a little exclamation mark next
to
his
never
name,
seen that.
Which I've never actually seen before.
He has an older version of Skype, hasn't updated it recently, because we're probably all on the 5.1 or more recent kind of thing.
Are you able to see that, or that's what that symbol means?
That's what that symbol means. He's got an out of date one. If you have an out of date Skype, your video won't be able to work on group conferences like this, because I've got an owned Skype account that I paid for. So you're capable of doing more than one video feed on any conversation. Like if you've got any more than two people on a conversation and you don't have a paid account, you can't do video at all.
Right.
And if you've got a paid account, you can have up to 10 people with video, and any more than that, it doesn't matter. You can just have, I think, what's the most people we've ever had on a call? I think it might be about 30 or 40 or 50 people or something on a call, but I don't know.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is.
So, Guillaume, are you there?
Yeah, finally. Okay, I just lost your son just before, and I just heard Vinny talk about Skype and the paid offer that enables you to more than two people. That's right, but I also think that there are alternatives, you know, and we are not obliged to use Skype and via Linux or type of. OS like that, you can find easiest way to bring many people, and I think in a better use and with a better flow. But that's only my point of view, and I got to work on it because I found many people that has that issue, not to be able to have more than two speakers with a video if they have not. A paid version of Skype. Did you get this, guys?
Yes. I always found the paid version of Skype has been really handy for me because I like to record webcam. Ultimately, it brings so much more dimension to the radio show. You know, being able to see somebody's expressions really in and of itself makes communication more complete, I think, and in radio, where expressions on people's faces and things like that are just kind of lost on you. You sort of have this imagination, and a lot of people tell me, you know, I don't look how they imagined I'd look, and it's like, well, that's because you imagined it instead of just looking at me, bro.
That's that's very much true, because first, when I got to your show, Vinny, and looked at it, the first thing that got me is that it was true. We were facing people, looking at their face, their expression, as you said, and that makes a real difference, really, you know. And the first time I've seen Alan, in fact, was on your show, because you had the webcam plugged. So, yeah, maybe the price is worth for a radio hoster, in order for people to be able to show their face and to see their expression live, which is not oftenly the case in radio shows.
You know, you're familiar with the term having a face for radio?
Yeah.
I think I'm probably one of the few radio show hosts in the world who actually does webcam like a straight on kind of thing, because a lot of people can find it quite distracting. In New Zealand, there's a number of different radio stations that do have a webcam that you can look live on their websites and things like that while the broadcasts are going. But the webcam's not right in front of them. You can barely even see their face. They're usually like up on the corner of a wall or something like that, or they're like sort of behind them or sort of over here. You know, it's not like a direct address. They don't look into the camera or whatever. And it's just kind of like, I always wanted to bridge this gap between the visual and the audio, which is basically what television is really all about. And people in general, have you noticed that listening audiences are mostly a lot older? If you've ever listened to talk radio late at night and to talkback and things like that, you will be overwhelmed by the amount of elderly people that are calling in almost exclusively, kind of thing. Has anybody else noticed that? You know, because it's a much older medium.
Oh yeah,
that they perhaps grew up with. And have you noticed that most of the things that you grow up with, you never grow out of?
People doesn't like to change,
especially old people. I've found they literally don't like change, because change is dangerous. Change is a young man's game.
It's kind of like going out in a journey out of home. You know, you want to keep staying at sweet home and don't move because you're too scared of losing a bit more. That's why especially old people are scared about changing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be like asking Bob Dylan to start doing hip-hop. I think with a few years, Bob Dylan could pull it off. You know, he's that good. But it would be a very scary first few years.
He tried that electric guitar thing, and that sure didn't work. So I don't know. He's sounding more and more like a rodent every day. It's kind of, he's looking more like one, too.
Was it, do you remember Billy Joel tried to do rap, and that ended up as We Didn't Start the Fire? No, I'm completely serious.
I'm serious.
He tried to write a rap song. That's what he came up with, and then realized he couldn't bug a rap. So he's like, "All right, well, I'll just kind of make it a Billy Joel song or whatever." But but Bob Dylan, I think, could do it.
He just needs the right DJ.
That's funny, because I was actually just thinking of Bob Dylan right before that, because when you were talking about the old people on the radio, I visualized those like bureaucratic guys. I can't remember what they're called, from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, who always want to recite poetry.
Vogons.
Really bad. And they just, the Vogons. They just go on and on. And then I was considering immediately, I just found out recently that where Douglas Adams got the number 42, why he chose that what the meaning was of what that meant, why it's the answer to life, the universe, and everything, was actually in reference to blowing in the wind. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind to how many roads. It's like how many roads a man must walk down before he can call him a man. His answer to that was 42 roads, which is still random and doesn't make any sense. But that's actually what it was in reference to. I saw that in an interview, which I was like, wow, that's interesting. And Bob Dylan, of course, is BD, which is 24, which is 42 backwards. But
well, hold on a second. So the answer, yeah. The answer is to the ultimate question in the universe, I just made shit up.
Yeah, that seems like that would be the answer, right?
Yeah.
If you could actually, like, meet God face-to-face, you know, and just, like, ask him, so, what's the meaning of life? I just kind of threw some shit together, thought I'd see what happened.
Yeah, yeah. Why did you create us? Why all the complications? Why all the words? Dude, I was just making shit up, you know? It's like God separate from his own consequences.
I was just fucking with you, as Bill Hicks says.
Or it should be just like, did I create anything?
God's running around burying fossils. I am killing me.
No, if you do something perfect, people won't be sure you've done anything at all.
Mm.
Yeah, Futurama?
Yeah.
Bender me God. This is explanation.
I was thinking about Futurama earlier. We were talking about the idea of the lion. Does the lion decide, I'm not going to do these horrible things anymore? I think it was actually on Futurama they had the vegan lion. Do you remember that? It was like just like a one-off thing.
I remember Larson, the Far Side calendar, and they had this lion just pouncing like, onto a pumpkin. And there's these other lions sitting there just like, Gerald's just trying to make vegetarian more exciting. and I saw this other one with these two lions sitting in a bush, and one you know kind of nudges the other one. He's like, dude, do the human mating call. And one goes, I'm so wasted.
On Futurama they did a vegan lion, which was just basically this lion where you could see like all its rib cage, and it was like breathing dust, and it was just like completely fading away. And they're like, look, we've managed to make this lion, you know, completely cut meat out of its diet or something, which of course does not work with a feline's body. So, some things are just made to kill.
Yeah. Yeah, like F-16s.
Yeah, exactly. F-16s, lions, you know,
presidents,
prime ministers, and kings. Let us build them shelves that they might fight amongst themselves.
Clergy. Or was that made for pedophilia? I was saying, never mind.
That's a form of death.
Yeah, I guess so. And in fact, There's big you know exposés about that kind of shit being thrown out all the time. I think I interviewed a guy on the show, forget his name, but he's investigating Canadian church child trafficking and rings and things like that. And they just killed thousands upon thousands of Native Canadian, you know, Eskimo type people, and you know, nobody gives a fuck about them. Nobody gives a fuck, and I've just wondered how much do you want to feel, right?
Wait, Vinny, let me ask you a question. Because let's say I took one of those Canadian Eskimo children into my home to protect them from the pedophile murderous priest, mm-hmm. would Bill tell me that they've become my slave?
No, you are their guardian.
I was taking a reference back to the cat. If you take the cat into your house,
I'm considering it, Alan.
Yeah, if I saved a poor Eskimo child, would you tell me that I've made that child my slave?
It depends. Again, like I said, slavery is the state of mind, and it's all and ergo, if you have a air of ownership over that child or over that cat. then regardless of whether or not that cat believes it's free or that child believes it's free, if you believe that you own it and you can prevent that child or cat from doing what they want, then in a way, yes, they're totally enslaved. But if you're just doing it out of the goodness of your heart and they're free to come and go as they please, and you don't really have any attachment or ownership for them, there really is no slavery. And I wish that was the case for employment. But in many cases, if I always felt that my employers felt like they owned me.
Well, I brought up that that movie Django earlier, which is in the news because of Tarantino's choice of historical arena, and that it deals with slavery, and he uses the word nigger liberally, and people have a very it hurts them emotionally to have to try to process it, to say, do I have to spend time with this to see what the value is in it? And I think that, you know, ultimately Tarantino's message in that movie is a commentary on institutions like the NFL and Hollywood, where if you have a talent that you're born into and you work at it and get to a certain level, the higher you get, the more chains that you have put upon you. So if you're an artist in Hollywood and your art is telling you to say a certain thing, and all of a sudden financing drops out, or actors drop out, or studios drop out, and all of a sudden you have no outlet for your art. But if you censor it or change it or adapt it, then all of a sudden the money and all that stuff comes through. Well, this is the whole Dave Chappelle thing. This is the whole realizing that the higher you get, the less free you become if you're an artist or an athlete, because you are asked to do things that you never thought you would be asked, that you are owned, that the contract you signed was not something that freed you, it was something that enslaved you. And I think if you look at that film that Tarantino has made, he puts the message in an exploitation film for a reason. It's very spelled out for me. It's very clear. It's a very brave movie, because he's warning people. If you think the road to freedom is in the football fields, or in Candyland, which is obviously Hollywood, you know, you will have to become an actor. You will have to be doing somebody else's business for the paradise that you think is awaiting you.
I think this is why COINTELPRO and the FBI really actively engage within Hollywood, because the most important thing, I think, throughout history for people in terms of evolving human consciousness or changing the way people think about things has really been through the entertainment industry. It's not really entertainment. It's life lessons being taught in the stories, like in the movie V for Vendetta, when they say, what was it? Great writers use lies to tell the truth, whereas politicians use lies to cover the truth up.
Yeah, amen. And that's why, I think that's why I have such a hard time dealing with the sort of wing. And again, I'm going to be very clear when I say this. Like, there is a certain wing within the specifically like YouTube conspiracy genre that's everything is just got to be labeled as part of the plan. And it seems to me that there is a great number of artists who really are trying to put truth out there, using lies to spread truth, or just, you know, dressing it up in fiction to put some truth out there, and to just completely disregard every attempt they make to put truth out there as being part of some bigger system. Granted, the institution's pretty damn devious. I have no love of Hollywood, but you know, I do think we can't write off every artist's attempt at doing something to elevate man out of the situation. It's a real shame. It's sort of a catch-22, because if the only way you can get the message out there is to deal with an insidious system, then, you know, is your message already perverted? These are, you know, fantastic questions that we can debate. I just, I think the intentions, it's very clear to me that many people have great intentions. Of course, we know that the road to hell is also paved with good intentions, or so I've heard. So,
And it just reminds me of in Hollywood, you know, what these allegations of Hollywood MK Ultra control and things like that. And Randy Quaid came out and talked about star whackers, that if you're a big Hollywood actor and you start coming out for the truth and things like that, you'll either be killed or demonized really, really badly or something of that nature. Corey Feldman, you know, former child star, comes out and he says that pedophilia is rampant in Hollywood, that it's the big secret. Tila Tequila comes out and says these similar things, and it's like, you notice this undercurrent if you have a look, like one person isolatedly, even if they're a famous person saying something by themselves, looks like a crazy person. But if that person, as well as a number of others, and then it becomes way, 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 way more difficult to deny these things. And it's like, hold on a second, is the thing that is entertaining us mostly, and hence the thing that is influencing us and our thoughts to a large degree, controlled by murderous, pedophile scum? And what kind of ramifications and what kind of, shall we say, effect does that have on mass culture? And are we getting worse as a culture? I mean, were there mass shootings back in, say, the 1930s or something, where nearly every kid in Texas was taking a gun to school?
There were mass murders of people put in gas chambers in the 1930s.
And that was also incidentally done in a gun ban zone.
So I think it's interesting. We started this conversation with the idea of, earlier before you came on, Vinny, there was like some part of a conversation about, was there value to be found in, say, even the Catholic Church, the teachings of the Catholic Church, minus the scumbaggery, the control, the basic lies? Is there a way to filter out all the other things that have been put on it and still find that kernel of truth? And I think with when it comes to any kind of media, that's essentially what you have to do, is you know that there are some pretty dastardly people who are trying to control this this system, to control the media that's put out there. But you can try and distill out what the message really is under all that stuff. It's just a lot of work if you're willing to do it, or if it's worth doing.
Well, let's say you take the Ten Commandments. Let's say you take the Ten Commandments, for instance, and you apply it to, say, U.S. presidents who claim that they are Christian. Okay, so let's say George W. Bush, "Thou shalt not kill. I will invade Iraq, kill a million Iraqis." Is he a Christian? No. Bill Clinton sleeps with gets his knob slipped by Slutsky Lewinsky. "Thou shalt not cover thy neighbor's Slutsky." No, he's not Christian. Okay, so on and so forth. All these people who claim to be something have actions which violate the very principles by which you could prove that I am such a person with such a moral authority as to be the leader of your country and things like that. And it's become widely known amongst a lot of Christian pastors and ministers that I've spoken to, at least, that there exist two branches of Christianity: those who claim that they're Christian and those who are Christian, those who follow actual principles of it. Like, for example, I think one thing that was real funny, one of them said to me, "Okay, this is God's law. This is all the laws to govern you and stuff like that. It's all in this one little book here." And I go, "Oh my God, that's about an eighth the size of the Patriot Act alone." Yeah. You know, simplicity, I think, is a hell of a lot easier. It's like when you complicate the amount of things that are governing your conduct to such minutiae,
as to have thousands upon thousands of pages of legislation just so that you can surveil people with warrantless wiretapping. There's something inherently fucked up about that.
And the fact that you can call that patriotism is the same way that you can call that, you know, someone can call it spirituality to say, oh, I'm anti-abortion, but I'm pro-death penalty and pro-war. You know, we have to, you have an excuse. We need to go kill a million Iraqis, even though I'm pro-war.
You need the babies to survive so that they can fight our wars for us. It's very, very plain logic.
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing, that same logic where someone will say they're a patriot and they believe in fighting for our country, even though they're stripping every liberty and everything that the country stands for. So again, it's you can be a patriot in name, you could be a Christian in name, or you could be something in principle. And it's always something very different. Guillaume, I know you were trying to get in here. Did you want to add something?
Yeah. In fact, that's quite funny that we're discussing that topic, because last time I was talking with Anthony Peake, and we were talking about the fact that we are indoctrinated at the very young age. And in fact, when you think that good and bad is defined at the basis of our lives, you know, to find the kernel, you know, the root one, it's quite very hard, I think. The more you grow, the more you are at some very high points, I think, modified by every way, you know. That's exactly the same that when you are trying to explain to someone how you see the red color, you're gonna say it's nearly purple, but the guy is saying exactly the same things, you know, the same difference of frequency in his eyes. So you can't really define it, you know. And I think in our society, you know, it's very hard to know that you are doing something from your own real wish, you know. And that's a real topic, you know. And sometimes it's a hard idea, but I'm thinking that maybe the trick is to think that life is important on Earth, you know? So they're going to bring you some scary death, so you are scared about death. They're going to show you that life is good when you have money. But the whole thing is they are never trying for you to escape life. They want you to stay here. Of course, we all know that they want us to work. Vinny would say that we are safe if we do it, and I pretty much agree. But yeah, all the definition, all the, how can I say, the operating system is plugged in at the first stage, you know. And yesterday I was discussing with another mother, from my girlfriend, a friend mother, and I was talking about this and all that crap inside it, and she was telling me, but you know, if I avoid my child to see the King Lion, other child will reject him from not having seen it, and again, and then I'm gonna make it being in a lonely place, in fact, because nobody will be able to discuss with him, because he won't have any real arguments to have, and it would be just totally in a different matrix. What do you think about that, guys?
See, it's real difficult, guys, to kind of hear what you're saying. A bit of distortion there, but I think what you're trying to say is that essentially people are living different lives, and instead of judging other people's life based on what that other person's life is like, they judge other people based upon what my life is like, kind of thing, and it's unfair. Is that sort of what you mean?
Yeah, sure. But also, in fact, what people are defining as good is coming from somewhere, and if you say that it's coming from your parents' education, for example, It's also coming from their education and so on and so on. So I'm just saying that to find a root kernel, so to see the real truth and to be sure that what you are thinking is your own thinking, you know, not modified by all the arguments that you can have. I'm talking like a programmer of a computer, because we say arguments, you know, to give sense to things. And I think I'm really on the question of how can I be sure of what I'm seeing, or even of what I'm thinking, and what word to put on it.
You know, I think you know part of the interpretation of this is that you need kind of self-confidence. I think if you're not confident in yourself and how you feel and who you are and what you're doing, like if you don't know yourself or you don't know your past, then somebody can tell you who you are or tell you what your past is, lie to you, and you won't know the difference, kind of thing. And it leaves you well open to manipulation. And this is actually how cults work. Is you come in, and the first thing they do is they tell you everything that you thought was real was a lie, and I'm now going to replace it with this truth. And secondly, they then put you into a herd mentality, so that you're not just the only one in there that's experiencing this, so you don't have freedom of thought by yourself. Then you get into a silo mentality with everybody else. Then they start to traumatize you, and you know, sleep deprivation or something of that nature. Same thing happens in the military, in boot camp. Same thing happens in law school, and same thing happens in medical school.
Same thing happens in your Alex Jones conspiracy world.
Exactly.
It's the same thing, the truth movement. Everything you know is a lie. I'm going to tell you what the truth is now. And now we need you to act on this truth by doing what we tell you to
Alan,
do. Stay up. Yeah.
Yesterday, I think, or it might have been the day before yesterday, after I saw that Piers Morgan interview with Alex Jones, cult leader.
Yeah.
That is what he came across as.
You know, I know a producer on the Piers Morgan show. And so I asked her, I said, what the fuck is up with Alex Jones? Was that all an act? Just to see if, who knows, maybe cameras are off. He calms down, gets out the door. She said, no, he's a fucking psycho. And they had to call security on him. That they were freaked out. That manic energy was not the product of a showman or an entertainer. That was just exploding out of him uncontrollably.
People who've produced Alex Jones, who have hosted in his stead and things of this nature. And I know his cousin, and they all got a similar opinion about him. It's megalomania on top of narcissism, right? Now, be that as it may, you can't point to a single person that wakes people up to at least a different reality and puts them perhaps on a different path than instead of wanting to be a servitude-ridden slave to the state or stupidity or the medical industry or something like that. He gets you out of that paradigm.
But the problem is he puts you
into a new one that he controls.
Yeah.
Okay,
right.
If you're gonna shatter somebody's paradigm of control, don't just put them into another control paradigm, because where the fuck are you going to end up other than where you exactly are right now anyway? And you wind up getting people who get woken up by Alex Jones and they get really badly disillusioned and then go straight back into enslavement because they felt deceived.
Absolutely. That's my issue. Yeah.
Right. And then they feel very cynical about everything that gets presented after that fact, because they were disillusioned and they're like, oh, there was really not as much to that. And then there's a reaction to anything that feels of a similar nature. And so it can close people down. But then at the same time, they can move on and open up and be disillusioned repeatedly. Hopefully you get disillusioned over and over and over again. You know, ideally, that's just what can continue. Needs to happen until you're just very more perceptive
What does the word disillusioned mean? It means I'm no longer operating under an illusion. How? It is not a bad thing. It is not a bad thing. It is a good thing, although it fucking hurts.
Vinny, I had an old friend email me, someone I hadn't spoken to in many years, who saw, I guess, things I was putting on Facebook and sent me something and said something, like accused me of being disillusioned. And I said exactly that. I said, well, disillusioned, yeah, means that I'm no longer under an illusion. And they just didn't respond ever again. It was like, okay, they reached out. Hey, I see you've gone crazy. I see what you're putting on Facebook. You must have gone crazy. And I'm like, no, it means you're no longer under an illusion. I was like, what you're saying is that I'm no longer under delusion. I assume you still are? That was it.
Just using those little minor interpretations. Well, we've come to the close up of the 2 hours. I mean, are you wanting to go longer, or are we wanting to wrap up soon enough?
You guys.
I actually got to get going, guys, and I'm doing the recording right now.
So that's the answer.
Okay. I've got 42% of battery left.
The number 42?
Yeah.
The show is the answer to the meaning of life.
Yeah. Hey, in fact, that was funny. The last house that I was living in was number 42, and the house across the road was number
33. Well, Vinny, you've been so gracious to be our guest again today. Is there anything you'd like to close up with, a parting message for the...
Yes, you can listen to my radio show at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and americanfreedomradio.com, and give me money there too, because like donations and subscriptions for like $5 a month or something like that, I give you ad-free archives. I'm recording this webcam and this thing too, so I'm going to put that up on YouTube and my archives page and all of that kind of stuff, and I'm producing hours upon hours of content a day. With some of the most important thinkers in the world, namely because normal conversations about nattering fucking bullshit bore the living shit out of me, and there's no fucking point. All right, I will force a good conversation to happen because I fear the alternative. Much like I will not ever have a job again because I can't do it. I literally can't. I have panic attacks if I seek gainful employment. All right, I can't do it. I'm employer phobic, and I think that people need to recognize that if you're having a bad time in your life, that's a good thing. If you're having a good time in your life, it's actually a bad thing. The reason why this is because people who've got it good all the time never question what's going on, never are upset with it, never evolve. Those who suffer constantly are being strengthened, who are evolving and have the potential to wake up to things that they never even thought possible. And so that's my encouragement to people. If you are feeling really, really comfortable with your life, with yourself, and with all your stuff, I say purposely get out of your comfort zone and make yourself remarkably uncomfortable. Make yourself go through some kind of trauma, and you will find different directions in your life. And this is something that happened to me. It's happened to many people that do this line of work. But thing is, recognize the fact that you're damaged goods, that there has been pain and trauma and stuff like that that has stuck upon you. But just because you're damaged goods doesn't mean you should go around trying to damage other people for the shit that's already happened to you that wasn't other people's fault, okay? Just because people have betrayed your trust doesn't mean you should never trust anybody again. Because if you don't have any trust for people at all, you can't have a real relationship ever again, okay? So that's my advice to people. Trust others,
You'll be pleased to know that I'm momentarily very uncomfortable and traumatized, and I'm sure this is going to lead to my evolution. So
there you go. There is no growth without pain, I think.
Get fucking used to it, you know.
You have some people who just like, why can't everything be easy? Well, it's just, dude, you're living on planet Earth, okay? It's not fucking possible. Get over it.
It's fucking painful.
Guillaume, thank you for joining us. I'm really glad you were able to.
even for a short while. It's good to actually get to speak to you. It's good to actually speak with you. It's been too long that we have.
Absolutely. Go on. Sorry.
Bill, do you want to tell everyone we have a guest next week? I think you're pretty excited about.
Jay Widener of Cooper's Odyssey fame, Room 237, will be joining us next week. So hope everyone tunes in. Should be interesting.
Well, please put me in contact with him as well, because I've been wanting to get Jay on my show for a while. I've even got a joke for him, you know how some people roll their joints with a trumpet on the end, kind of thing. You know how you do that with a Jay Widener.
Yeah.
That's what that's called, right? Isn't that the official name?
Thanks for joining us, Vinny, and I really hope that you come back soon and join us and keep touch, because I think this is a very good show, good energy.
Well, thank you. All right, guys, well, you have yourselves a lovely day, and I'm just going to, prepare for my show now. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, everybody. Thank you all very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Adios.